Goodness knows what you're going to get today. Padma Vajra and I have completely lost it. We're away with the fairies. We've fed on honeydew and drunk the milk of paradise and the divine ecstatic soma. So let's see. That means it's probably going to be very flat and boring today. We're going to mainly concentrate today on the contemplation of asubha subha. But before I start my exploration of that, I want to follow up briefly one of the questions from yesterday, asked by Hattie, I think it is. She asked about tanha and the skandhas and niyamas and so on. So, in the midst of floods and floods of inspiration, I recognized that the three kinds of desire that I spoke of yesterday could be put under the headings of mano-niyama, karma-niyama, and dharma-niyama. So the first kind of desire, which is hunger, thirst, instinctual desire, comes under the heading of mano-niyama. The second kind, which is to do with the defense of ego identity, comes under the heading of karma niyama. And the third kind, which is eros proper, comes under the heading of dharma niyama. Of course, karma niyama desire has two kinds, skillful and unskillful. But actually, you could take the whole theme far further, and for the Schopenhauerians, one can recognize villa at every level through the niyamas. And I was immediately reminded then of Dylan Thomas's famous poem, "The Force That that Through the Green Fuse Drives the Flower." It's said to be inspired by Schopenhauer, and in that poem, he's giving expression to the way in which eros, in our language, expresses itself in nature and in us. And for Abhaya's sake, I'm going to read it, although I won't read it as well as Abhaya does. I'm not going to try the Welsh accent. Terry Williams there could do it, I know, but... "The force that through the green fuse drives the flower," by Dylan Thomas. "The force that through the green fuse drives the flower drives my green age. That blasts the roots of trees is my destroyer. And I am dumb to tell the crooked rose, my youth is bent by the same wintry fever. The force that drives the water through the rocks drives my red blood. That dries the mouthing streams turns mine to wax. And I am dumb to mouth unto my veins how at the mountain spring the same mouth sucks. The hand that whirls the water in the pool stirs the quicksand. That ropes the blowing wind hauls my shroud sail. And I am dumb to tell the hanging man how of my clay is made the hangman's lime. The lips of time leech to the fountainhead. Love drips and gathers. But the fallen blood shall calm her sores. And I am dumb to tell a weather's wind how time has ticked a heaven round the stars. And I am dumb to tell the lover's tomb how at my sheet goes the same crooked worm." So I found during these days that poetry, literature, film scenes from films are just constantly coming into my mind as we're striking deeper into this theme. Words become less and less adequate, and images and artistic expression becomes more and more the valid medium. So to deal with the next issue, I'm going to refer to another very powerful work of art, for me one of the most powerful and important, which is going to be my indirect approach into the question of the contemplation of the shubha, ashubha. And it's that very great cinematic masterpiece, Stalker, by Andrei Tarkovsky, which is, for me, one of the most important works of art I know. And in that extraordinary film, if you haven't seen it, it's very beautiful. It's beautifully shot, beautifully paced. So the rhythm of the film draws you deeper and deeper and deeper into contemplation. There's nothing else to be said for it. And Tarkovsky famously said that his films don't have a logic of narrative. They're not concerned with the logic of story. They're concerned with the logic of images. So the story, if you could call it a story, is told beneath the surface of your conceptual mind. The images are speaking to you all the time. So you have a strong feeling of having seen something, of realized something, without being exactly sure what it is. In the narrative of the film, there's a mysterious zone that appears, and you're never told how or why or whatever. But in that zone, odd things happen. In that zone, there's a room which, it said, in which all your desires are fulfilled. The film is really a meditation on desire, on hope and on faith. It's very, very powerfully and movingly explored. And the central character is Stalker, who is a classic Russian divine fool, who is both exceptionally innocent and at the same time deeply inspired and full of wisdom. And he leads people into the zone, which is forbidden, and they have to go through guards and they're shot at and so on. And he leads a professor, in other words, a scientist, and a writer, in other words, a representative of the arts, so to speak. He leads them in, and each of the characters is simply referred to by their occupation, so to speak. In other words, they're taken out of the realm of the personal. They go into the heart of the zone, which is a desolate industrial, post-industrial landscape somewhere in Estonia. Not that you know this. And they're led into it, and apparently it's full of danger. And you become more and more sensitive to the potentialities in that zone. As you're approaching the final entry towards the room where all desires are fulfilled, Stalker becomes sort of ecstatic, and he's in despair at the lack of reverence of the artist, of the writer and the professor. I don't need to comment on what that means. He becomes he becomes furious at their failure to revere what they're doing and their doubts and their casual approach and so forth. And their failure to recognize the dangers of what they're doing. Oh, such a metaphor for what we're doing. And he suddenly turns around and in a very, very intense, incantatory way, he recites a poem which happens to be by Tarkovsky's father, Arseny. The poem goes thus. It's called "But There Has to Be More." I can't do it like Stalker does because I don't speak Russian. You've got to be Russian, which has a unique sort of depth and power to it. Now summer is gone and might never have been. In the sunshine it's warm, but there has to be more. It all came to pass, all fell into my hands like a five-petaled leaf, but there has to be more. Nothing evil was lost. Nothing good was in vain. All ablaze with clear light. But there has to be more. Life gathered me up, safe under its wing. My luck always held. But there has to be more. Not a leaf was burnt up. not a twig ever snapped. Clean as a glass is the day. But there has to be more. But there has to be more. That is Ashubha. There has to be more. I don't know about you, but immediately that poem speaks to me of a constant underlying theme of my experience. However wonderful things are, however beautiful, there has to be more. There's always a sense that although life can be astonishingly beautiful, astonishingly perfect even, at moments, like a lovely summer's day at Adisthana, there has to be more. You know somewhere in you that it's not fulfillment. That is Ashubha. It's a powerful, immediate felt experience that you have not seen the highest beauty. But what you've seen, even as beauty, is not the highest beauty. It is but a reflection of it. That is Ashubha. We have been arguing that really Bhante is suggesting that Ashubha could be added to the list of Lakshanas. And the Bhante definitely says that he thinks that Shubha could be added to the list of Imokshamukhas, the gateways to liberation. And if it's a gateway to liberation, it must have something that it liberates from. What it liberates from is the Ashubha, the sense that you have not got more. You have not got what there is that's more, that's fully and completely and deeply satisfying, satisfyingly beautiful, fulfillingly beautiful. You haven't got it. And I realise that for me, the dukkha and Ashubha are the characteristics of conditioned existence that most closely touch me. Yes, I do reflect, of course, on impermanence. I do reflect on the lack of fixed substance within and without. But those tend to be more reflections. What really strikes me, and strikes me on a daily, moment-by-moment basis almost, is this strong sense of unfulfillment. Unfulfillment in these two senses. Unfulfillment in the sense of not full happiness, not full ease, not full peace. And in this sense of not full satisfaction, not full experience of a final attraction, or a final union with the attractive, with beauty. That the sense that always the beautiful is distant is not fully realized. Of course, it doesn't present itself like that. It's more usually just a sort of kind of sense of boredom and unease and looking for distraction and trying to find ways to palliate and avoid and ways to put off recognizing what I feel. Because it's almost impossible to face it directly. It's almost overwhelming. If you face dukkha and Ashubha fully, it's almost unbearable. I remember an encounter with, you know, minor but not inconsiderable English poet, George Barker. I knew his son quite well, and I used to go occasionally to his Saturday evening drinking parties, at which, as his children said, he used to eat people, and used especially to eat young people, and he ate me for sure. But that's another story. On one occasion, I arrived there, and I was just sitting quietly, minding my own business, looking out the window at a beautiful spring day, with a lilac outside the windows of the National Trust rectory that he lived in. And he came in, he just made a beeline for me, and stood over me and said, poetry is like Perseus' shield. It enables us to stare at what would otherwise turn us to stone. through art, through poetry, we're able to look at what we can't face directly, because it would just burn us up. It would just freeze us to stone. We can't face the ashupa, we can't face dukkha too directly. So we sort of skirt round the edges of it, occasionally looking a little bit deeper in and then backing off again. But I think if we sort of examine our lives closely, we will in all honesty recognize that this experience of the lack of final union, the lack of final completion, the lack of something that is deeply, deeply satisfying, that is completely beautiful, is a powerful factor in our lives. We're constantly sort of eaten away at by it. And often we're trying to find ways of compensating, of palliating, of deadening. Sometimes think that the kind of people who become strongly addicted to drugs or drink often are the sort of people who feel it so strongly. Dylan Thomas being a case in point. He clearly felt the blinding, burning brilliance of reality in a way that he just could not bear, and eventually just drowned himself in drink. So the ashubha means the not going out to find something ugly. That is a practice, of course, that's used as a compensation for excessive desire. And unfortunately, in the current tradition, ashubha bhavana is only seen in those terms. You know, if you are overly addicted to the opposite sex, and you know you cannot sort of get them out of your mind when you're meditating, you reflect on what their bodies are really like when you, you know, cut them open, or when you put them in the graveyard or whatever. You contemplate the rotting corpse and so forth. But this seems to me an extreme measure for extreme disease. This is certainly what Bhante says. He doesn't recommend it for most of us. But I think that if we confined the notion of contemplation of ashupa to that, we'd be missing a huge significance of reality. That reality is marked by the ashubha. It's not something that we just find as a sort of compensation, or cancellation of an excessive desire in one direction. Although clearly it's related to the central theme. But I believe it's something that any honest person will find present in their daily experience, and that you will find pressing up within you, bumping up against you, kind of all the time, in every situation. And what Buddhism does is ask us to take that on, to fully recognize that actually the way we live, the way we see things, is not going to reveal real beauty. We see some beauty, and that some beauty can be a means of entry into the highest beauty of that more later. But most of the time we don't experience that. And it's not just that we don't experience it, we experience its lack. That's what ashubha means, that to be conscious, to be a conscious human being, is to experience the lack of beauty in our daily lives, in our daily experience. So if we're asking how do we practice down this path of beauty that Padmavajra and I have been stumbling, you know, to clear away the brambles from in ourselves, the first thing is to recognize the absence of beauty. Not relatively speaking. There's relatively speaking a certain amount of beauty. You know, how can we say that on a beautiful spring day with the grass electric green and the trees in all their spring glory, still with the chestnuts with their candles on and so on? How can we say there's no beauty? But it's only relative beauty. What Ashubha Bhavana requires us to do, I believe, is not develop that, but recognize that as part of our present experience. Recognize that there is a sense of, but there has to be more. However beautiful that the summer's day is, as Arseny Tarkovsky sings, however beautiful it is, there has to be more. However wonderful things are, however well they unfold, there has to be more. Full beauty has not yet flowered. And if we don't recognize that, we will not take the steps that lead to its flowering. I think that in all of Buddhism, this is the most central theme, really. That for the Buddha to be revealed, you need to recognize his absence. And so on. You can see that in every field. You cannot go straight to the Buddha. You have to recognize that you feel his absence. It was very, very powerful last night with the kusha grass in front of us, with the empty throne. I don't know whether anybody else felt this, but I felt the Buddha's presence more strongly by his absence on that throne than I did from the stone figure on the shrine. I often feel that that would be a really effective way of setting up a shrine. In fact, at Bodh Gaya, this is what I find. You see the Vajrasana, and there's nobody there. And somehow or other, that speaks more strongly, the absence of the Buddha speaks more strongly of his presence than his presence, or the representation of his presence would, to me at least. So I think in the Buddha Dhamma, we need to always start with the absence within ourselves. And so the Ashubha is not recognizing, ew, that's ugly. It's not like that. It's recognizing that however beautiful, however attractive it is, there has to be more. That's what Ashubha means. That's what Ashubha Bhavana means. It means looking at, recognizing what actually is there. Just as the same with dukkha. It's not looking at suffering things and saying, oh, that's suffering. Suffering is there all the time because we've not reached fulfillment. We've not reached freedom. We're still trapped in egoistic delusion. So, yeah, the Ashubha Bhavana consists in acknowledging, not in looking for or creating, consists in acknowledging the sense of lack, the sense of lack of real beauty. But that, of course, is not the end of it. Otherwise, it's the path to, drink, drugs and death, as it were. It's the path of the modern artist who can see so blindingly the absence of true beauty, but has no sense of where to find it. So let's look now a little bit at Shubha Bhavana. And here we're still addressing our experience. We're not just sort of setting up a pretty picture, although that could be a way of doing it. We're also trying to look at what is going on in our immediate experience. We're recognizing our direct experience. We're recognizing, that full beauty has not revealed itself to us, but we also recognize that we see that the shadow of beauty as it disappears around the corner, as it were. We see the rays, from the setting sun glowing in the sky, even though we don't see the sun. So we see that in our experience, there is some reflection of that ideal and ultimate beauty. We pick up that it's not there fully, but we also pick up that it is there. It is reflected in our immediate experience. And again, I don't mean simply the beauty of loveliness. Beauty can also be found in the terrible, in the sublime, even in the destructive. We were talking the other day about the last scene of Hamlet with a stage full of bodies. It's not sort of conventionally beautiful, But the beauty of the whole dramatic unfoldment and the beauty of what Hamlet discovers in this tragic flow leaves one with a supremely uplifted spirit at the end of this disastrous play, if you like. And you can see that in so many other dark works. I remember going into the exhibition in the Prado with Goya's dark rooms, his dark paintings. And they are dark, both in terms of colour and in terms of theme. But there's something also extraordinarily potent, even beautiful, about them. So when I'm talking of beauty, I'm not talking merely of prettiness or of comfortable beauty. Beauty is not comfortable. In a way, both Arseny Tarkovsky and Dylan Thomas's poems are not comfortable poems. Although they're beautiful and create beautiful images, they're also juxtaposed with a note of longing and even destruction that is quite disturbing. So, yes, when I'm talking about the intuitions of beauty, I'm not meaning merely the pretty or the lovely. I'm talking about something that suggests a beauty, a full and final beauty that is completely beyond our earthly realm, but that leaks through or seeps through or is reflected through to varying degrees at varying levels in varying ways our ordinary experience. And the path of beauty, the Shubha Marga, to coin a phrase, the path to the Vimoksha Mukha of Shubha, lies in tracing these gleams of beauty, these faint glows of beauty, like, you know, light coming round the cracks of a door. You can see the intense light just gleaming, just a sliver of light down the side or under the bottom. And you sense that through that door is the final light, a light so intense, so overwhelming, that all is resolved. And you by seeing that gleam and by addressing that gleam, by coming back to that gleam again and again, you come closer and closer to the door. And eventually, when you become close enough, of course, you can open it and pass through. But our path lies in this dual action of recognizing our felt existential experience of lack of aesthetic fulfillment. The fact that there's a bum note in every beautiful piece, that there's something failed in every scene. You know, you can see the factory smoke on the horizon, even though the scene is so beautiful. Like here, you go out, you see this lovely countryside, and then you see a big asbestos barn right in the middle of it all. Of course, I'm not merely talking about aesthetic imperfection of that kind, that somehow or other, even the greatest perfection, of greatest beauty, only speaks of something further, and the whole trend and tendency of mundane beauty is to take you into a contemplation of what goes beyond the mundane. That's one's instinct, almost, is to dwell not on the work, but on the where it launches you. It launches you into a contemplation that goes beyond itself. This is what I said, that beauty is transcending, self-transcending. A beautiful anything suggests something further. And if you launch yourself into that further, that more, you're coming closer on the path of beauty. So I've probably said enough, and it's time for Padmavajra to follow it through in his own ecstatic way. He's been drinking a lot of the divine ecstatic soma over the last few days. And in fact, I'm a little bit worried about him, that is something that's going to burst sooner or later. But I hope I've sort of given you a pith of what it is that is this path of beauty. It's not looking for something. It's not thinking about something. This is the power of beauty as a path. It doesn't involve reflection in the sense of conceptualization. To be honest, so much of what I hear as insight practice, yea, even in our movement, strikes me so damn heady. And it just provokes thinking in me. And maybe that's my inadequacy. And I'm sure that, you know, for others it doesn't. But so much of it is so heady, so theoretical, so conceptual. Of course, the conceptual can be a gateway to something more. The power of beauty is it directs us to our actual immediate sense of imperfection, lack of fulfillment, lack of an abiding beauty, lack of a really satisfyingly final beauty, and our sense of the intimation of the highest beauty. That, I think, is what we need to focus on. And you don't need special equipment. You don't even need to spend lots of money on an expensive retreat. You don't even need a leader, because you've got the equipment. You've got it right there. And it's simply a question of addressing your own constant sense, which I can guarantee everybody feels, that you've not got full satisfaction. However good it is, it's not enough. There has to be more.